Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With the arrest of Rupert Murdoch's protege, Rebecca Brooks, we'll begin with the unfolding scandal that appears to be tearing the news international empire and the Murdoch family apart. Journalist, editor, and award-winning author James Fellows joins us. He is the national correspondent of The Atlantic, and we will discuss the apparent payback the political kingmaker is getting in England, where the spell has been broken as politicians no longer fear Murdoch and his minions. Then we will look into the non-appointment of Elizabeth Warren to head up the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau she founded, which opens on Tuesday, with a new person in charge, former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray. With the Republicans apparently determined to scuttle a new bureau, we will look into the battle shaping up next week in Congress with Jennifer Taub, professor at the Vermont Law School, whose forthcoming book is titled The Great Betrayal: How Washington Bailed Out Wall Street and Left Main Street Underwater. Then finally, Yasmin El-Rashidi joins us. She has an article in the current edition of the New York Review of Books titled Egypt, the Victorious Islamists. We will discuss the stalled revolution as the ruling Egyptian military council maneuvers with the Muslim Brotherhood to deny the revolutionaries the fruits of their victory in Tahrir Square. I'm now joined by James Fellows, who is the award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. He's also the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, and Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Fellows.
Ian, very nice to talk to you once again.
And James, you've been writing in The Atlantic about this extraordinary mental gymnastics, shall we say, that the Fox News stalwarts are going through to suggest in some way that Murdoch and News International are the victims of a hacking problem rather than the perpetrators. It would seem that I think this reflects a culture that I think is apparent with Fox and with Murdoch, is that they can dish it out, but they can't take it.
Yes, and the thing which really got my attention was a segment on Fox and Friends, which I'll confess I don't watch regularly, but I saw a YouTube clip where on Friday, when everything was hitting the fan, they had on a so-called hacking expert who was actually a PR man, and they said, yes, hacking is really becoming a big problem worldwide. It's happened to the Pentagon. It happened to Citibank. It's happened to News of the World. And you think, wait a minute, News of the World was the one that was doing the hacking. But I think you're right. There has been an embattled culture in the Murdoch news empire for a very long time, and the question is whether the cumulative effect of the things they're being caught as doing now, whether that's going to have make a lasting difference in how they do business.
Well, with the arrest of Rebecca Brooks, who's apparently a protege of Rupert Murdoch's, and I'm told by my British journalist friends that she's actually somebody that he was who was important to his succession. Do you detect a kind of Shakespearean quality to this, James Fellows, as the family's members maneuver? You know, you've got James, the heir apparent, now looking like he might be facing jail time. You've got Elizabeth from a prior marriage, who, from all accounts, is very competent and perhaps waiting in the wings. And now you've got Rebecca Brooks out of the way. And then, of course, you've got the more recent Chinese wife, Wendy Deng, who's apparently going her own way, producing movies and, for all intents and purposes, separated from Murdoch.
Indeed, I think that were Shakespeare around, this would be great material. Were Orson Welles still around, this could be a modern Citizen Kane with allowances for difference in technology, differences in politics, and difference in national setting. And the whole generational saga, of course, of Rupert Murdoch coming from a great Australian newspaper dynasty, of establishing himself so prominently with U.S. citizenship and a U.S. base, with his very very significant role in U.K. politics over the past generation plus, you have every aspect of a rich human story coming together here. You have families, you have life cycles, you have different parts of the family layered in, you know, rival offspring, rival wives. You have national differences between the U.S. and U.K., journalistic styles. You have Murdoch's visionary role in various kinds of technology aspects of journalism, perhaps now catching up with him, and you have political intrigue of all sorts. So this is indeed a rich tale, apart from its significance.
And James Fellows, again, a veteran journalist and national correspondent for The Atlantic. The clearly, though, the spell has been broken in terms of the role that Murdoch and News International has played as being the political kingmaker in the United Kingdom, I guess to a lesser extent here. After all, when the Republican field for those wanting to become the next president of the United States was first introduced, I think a goodly number of them are already on Fox News contracts. But it does appear that the spell is broken. And Cameron, of course, the Prime Minister, is quite deeply embroiled because his press aide was is one of the people that's been arrested. I've likened this situation that's been going on in England for a long time now, where Murdoch basically decides who's going to be Prime Minister. Tony Blair had to pay fealty. Gordon Brown had to, and they went ahead and hacked his doctor's records, which is akin to the Nixon going after Ellsberg's psychiatric records. But just in terms of American analogies, doesn't this feel a little bit like J. Edgar Hoover, the way he blackmailed congressmen and senators?
Very much so. And I think it's interesting that in both countries, the UK and the US, Murdoch and his publications have been very influential, but in different ways. As you say, in the UK, since Murdoch bought a variety of publications a generation plus ago, he's been at the center of politics across party. And with the apparent connection of his publications and the police, you did have this J. Edgar Hoover type overhang. In the U.S., it's been different in that the Murdoch publications, led by Fox News, but also the Weekly Standard and the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, although it had this role even before Murdoch, they've had the combined roles of being very, very influential on the right, where the Republican Party has had Fox News as its most influential propaganda organ, I would say. And he's been influential across party, mainly as the opposition voice. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were very, very heavily influenced by the attacks and the characterizations that Fox News was able to launch. So in both countries, he's had a big role. I think the UK role has certainly changed. The question will be whether a year from now, 5 years from now, we see that his role as the main face of conservatism has changed or not.
And in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly of this story, the ugly, of course, is Millie Dowler, the 13-year-old who was murdered, and for 6 months they couldn't find her body. Meanwhile, News Corp journalists and operatives, I guess, whose checks are being signed by James Murdoch, they were out deleting phone messages in her, which of course pained the parents enormously. And not only were they destroying evidence, but they gave the parents the illusion that the child was alive. This has really shocked the conscience of the nation. Plus, it's forced Murdoch to do a mea culpa, and apparently he was very contrite, shall we say. That's the ugly. Do you want to add anything to that? Because I wanted to get onto the good.
Well, the ugly, I think it took that episode and also the apparent hacking into the phone accounts of victims of terrorism in England to really make this not just a political dispute, but something that was deeply repellent to everybody at a human level. And I think that's why even David Cameron played the role that was saying that Rebecca Brooks had to leave, et cetera. So, yes, I agree that's the ugly.
Well, in terms of the good, though, I think that there's no question that The Guardian, which is an interesting model, which perhaps we can talk about in terms of the press, it's a trust. The Guardian newspaper, the reporter Nick Davies and their investigative reporter were really doggedly stuck at this story. Nobody else on Fleet Street supported him. He had tremendous resistance and described by the editor of The Guardian as a fusillade of lies from News International. No cooperation, indeed hostility from his fellow journalists. He stuck with the story and eventually he's been vindicated. And he's now being compared to the British equivalent of Woodward and Bernstein.
Yes, and I think that all credit needs to go to the Guardian and its care and persistence on this. And It's interesting that over the past year plus, there have been two disparate episodes which have, I think, reemphasized the importance of traditional journalism, and The Guardian has been involved in both of them. One is the whole WikiLeaks case in which the New York Times, The Guardian, Spiegel, and I think, I don't know if there's another organization, essentially were charged with vetting what information Assange was putting out and seeing which things are fit to publish or not. And now this case, where without the professional resources that The Guardian was able to bring to bear, it's likely the story might have might never have come to light.
Well, apparently the story was in trouble, and the Guardian weren't getting any support from the British press. Nobody else was picking up on it. But what gave the story legs and infused it with some juice, if you will, was the New York Times. They sent three journalists over. Obviously they also cooperated on the WikiLeaks, along with the El País was the fourth.
Yes, thank you for that. I had forgotten which was the other organ that was involved. And I think you can certainly confirm with me, for most American listeners, I think many Americans have the idea of the British press as being an all very high-toned operation. And in fact, at its high levels, it can be high-toned. At its low levels, it can be quite a bit more raucous and crude than what is normally respectable within the U.S. context. That's why so many American tabloid editors have come or been trained in the U.K. or on Fleet Street. So you can see why the News of the World got away with this for a while, but then this decade's worth of pushing the envelope has finally caught up with them.
Well, perhaps it will come across here in the sense that Piers Morgan's one of their protégés.
Yes, I will be. You know, it has been fascinating to see how Fox News has not covered this story at all. The Wall Street Journal, one of the jewels in our journalistic establishment, I think has not distinguished itself by the coverage of the story. We'll see how they do over the next week or two. We'll also see how Piers Morgan does in the days ahead on CNN.
Well, apparently the FBI are looking into the possibility that News International reporters here in the United States hacked into victims of 9/11, which again is so unseemly that it's likely to generate the similar outrage here in the United States.
Yes, I think that's the one topic on which the normal partisan divide might be surmounted, and people wouldn't otherwise, in other circumstances, be loyal to Fox News and think that any critics of Fox News must be somehow ignoble in their motivations. This could have the same repellent factor that the Dowling case did in England. So this is the other point I'd make is that I was just out of college and a reporter in D.C. when the Watergate scandal was breaking. What is similar so far is the fact that every day there's something new, and so far something you would have been astonished by a week beforehand. To have the News of the World closed, to have the B Sky B deal withdrawn, to have Brooks apparently being arrested, to have Les Hinton resign, none of these would have been believable at all even a month ago. And that is, I think, also it suggests poor management of the story, at the least, by the Murdoch interest in just sort of letting these things drip out day by day by day.
Well, it's a reminiscent of the old Watergate adage that the cover-up's worse than the crime.
Yes, and in this case, the crime was plenty bad enough.
Well, exactly. Well, I must say, though, James, fellas, I'm a tiny bit amused by the New York Times' schadenfreude, shall we say, in covering this story. There's clearly no love lost between the New York Times and Murdoch.
Yes, but can you blame them? Right. Can you blame them? This is their opponent over the decades that has always sort of poo-pooed them for having these preacherly high standards and for all their own failings, now being caught in the most egregious way, and every suspicion that you've had has been confirmed. So I think I understand on a human level where the Times is coming from. I might even have such feelings myself. Who could say?
Well, let's maintain our veneer of objectivity here. What about, though, just in closing then, the lessons for the media in general? I mean, one lesson clear seems to me to be, which is, I think, an interesting one, is not just the role of The Guardian, but the way it's set up as a trust.
Yes.
which it makes it immune from a lot of the whims of newspaper magnates using their publishing organs as a private soapbox, you know. And I mean, it used to be restrained by the fairness doctrine, you know.
Yes.
Where titans couldn't, if they wanted to proselytize their own points of view and promote their agendas, they had to offer equal time to an opposing point of view. That's gone, thanks to President Reagan. So, where do we stand in that regard?
I think this has been a useful reminder that of the three main ways ownership can be structured in for news organizations, which is the strict corporate model, the individual tycoon model, and the nonprofit model, each of them has their strengths and weaknesses. We've been very much exposed in the last 10 years to the weaknesses of the corporate model. For example, the problems of the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, as Sam Zell has come in. We have seen people have often clung to the benefits of the tycoon model, saying the Sulzbergers and the Grahams for a while kept their publications on the high road, as the Chandlers had done in Los Angeles years ago. And then there is the nonprofit model, which The Guardian exemplifies, which in a way NPR has its role. You know, it's the state supported and public supported. So I think in the long run, none of these models is perfect. But a balance, they each have certain assets, and The Guardian's performance here has been a sign of the kind of strength that model can give. So I think we're going to see a mixture of these three models going forward.
By the way, though, I think you have to add the BBC to this, because the BBC in London is absolutely, Murdoch's obsessed with it. It's his number one enemy. He'd like to bring it down. And the reason I think they have more diversity in the press in England is because of the BBC, that you couldn't get, you know, that Fox can get away with the extreme speech here, but not in the way that, because there's always the BBC to pull them over and do a fact check.
Yes, and I think that is a very important, I'll use the term advisedly, legacy asset that both, that in different ways the UK, Canada, and Australia have, of having strong, independent, state-supported news organizations. In the U.S., that is the case with NPR. Public TV is in a much more embattled situation. So it is a sign of how important that is. So, yes, I would include that in the mix very much so.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, James Fellows.
It's a pleasure to speak with you again. Bye.
Bye. Again, I've been speaking with James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. He's also the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress? Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, and Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how come Elizabeth Warren didn't get the job that she created. Every weekend through the door come words of wisdom from the world outside. If you want to know about the bishop and the actress, if you want to know how to be a star, if you want to know about the stains on the mattress, you can read it in the Sunday papers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Jennifer Taub, who is a professor at the Vermont Law School. Previously, she coordinated the business law program in the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She was also an associate general counsel for Fidelity Investments and assistant vice president for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. Her forthcoming book from Yale University Press is called The Great Betrayal: How Washington Bailed Out Wall Street But Left Main Street Underwater. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And clearly, since you're a friend of Elizabeth Warren's, in terms of disclosure here. You must be disappointed. But do we know whether or not she's disappointed that she's not going to get the job that she created on Tuesday?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what is happening on the inside. Though I'm acquainted with her, I'm by no means, you know, aware of what went on in that room and when the decision was made. But what's, you know, folks are very disappointed. I mean, she is clearly the best person to lead this bureau, but the second choice is also a great man. And it reminds me of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s last speech. He was a great civil rights leader, and as you may recall, he said that he'd been to the top of the mountain, and he was able to look over and see the Holy Land, but he wasn't sure he was going to get there with all of us. And I think it's kind of the same thing. She envisioned this agency. She fought to get it to be included within the Dodd-Frank reform legislation. She spent the last year building it, hiring people, setting up the protocols. And even though she won't be there the day it actually stands on its own feet, she's done incredible work.
But it's pretty clear, is it not, Jennifer Taub, that the Republicans either want to neuter this agency or destroy it altogether?
That's right. This is not the end of the story, although it's been leaked to the press that the White House has decided who will be nominated. It's not clear to me that Richard Cordray will be able to be approved by the Senate. As we've talked about in the past, there is a group of 44 Republicans who have said they will basically confirm nobody unless this bureau is substantially changed, substantially weakened in terms of its authority, in terms of its funding, and in terms of how much oversight will be had over it. It would be, as you said, substantially neutered if the Republicans who've made this demand get their way.
Well, essentially what they want to do is to make it a commission, not a bureau, which would mean that you'd have appointed Republicans and Democrats, and the model would be the futures Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which we know has not done its job in terms of how the price of oil and food have been gamed over the last few months to record high prices and then suddenly mysteriously come down as soon as senators like Bernie Sanders start talking about the need to investigate manipulation on Wall Street with the price of gas and food. So there's an example of what the Republicans want, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that commissions are easily rolled politically, but bureaus have more independence.
Right. It's terribly ironic because typically one would think of conservatives as complaining about ineffective government and slow processes and red tape and how isn't it too bad that government doesn't operate more like a business. And as we know, businesses aren't run by committees. There's often a chief executive officer, somebody, you know, for whom the buck stops there. And if this bureau, as this bureau was designed by law, there is a director, not a board. And so that is one of the demands that this group, 44 Republicans, who then, you know, who would have the power to block through filibuster her appointment have made. I mean, there are two other demands as well to increase the kind of oversight over the rules that this a new regulatory council called the FSOC, the Financial Services Oversight Council, already under law has tremendous oversight over the rules that this bureau could put out. This is unique to have this approval and veto authority, and this group of Republicans wants to strengthen that authority, which would thereby water down the types of rules to protect consumers that the bureau could create. And also, as you know, the hope is to change the appropriations, which is the funding for this bureau. Presently, the funding set out by law would be set relative to a percentage of the Federal Reserve's budget. So it would be an automatic budget that the Bureau could have, which would be consistent and would be predictable. But this group wants to change that and make the appropriation, the amount of money this bureau would have, or I guess they want it to be more like a commission, as you said, but they would like it to be subject to the annual appropriations process, which would allow Congress to punish the bureau if it, let's say, got too tough on one of the banks or other financial services companies. And that's a substantial fear. If you have someone coming in to investigate or to enforce regulations against a very large and powerful bank, if the result of that is that bank then turns around and either lobbies heavily or helps fund the campaign or creates issue ads against someone in the House or Senate and gets their person elected, then that person will then be somebody who tries to cut the budget of the bureau. So, you know, there's a reason why banking agencies should have independent funding, and all the other banking agencies do. Not the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, nor the CFTC. They don't have independent budgets, and that's the trouble they're facing right now as a result. But the banking agencies do, for the reasons that I mentioned.
Well, Jennifer Tabb, again, a professor at Vermont Law School, an expert on business law. In effect, you're segueing me to the front page story in Saturday's New York Times by James Stewart, who I recently interviewed. He has a very interesting book out now about the some of the egregious law cases, Madoff and the Valerie Plame case. But he's now got a new column with the New York Times as a financial investigator. And he sat down with the current head of the enforcement for the Securities Exchange Commission. And basically, this article points out that just recently the Republican-controlled Appropriations Committee cut the Securities and Exchange Commission's fiscal 2012 budget by $222.5 million basically put that money back in Wall Street's pocket because they have essentially neutered the enforcement arm of the SEC.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. We hear on the one hand, in this time of budget talks, that we need to shrink the government expenditures. But the SEC is funded through fees and also through penalties. Although it doesn't get to keep the money it brings in, it has to hand it over to the Treasury, and then it gets its allotment. The idea that somehow cutting the SEC's budget will save the taxpayers is not true. And in fact, what's fascinating about Stewart's article in the Times is that he points out that quite the opposite will happen. If the SEC's budget is cut, then the fees that are collected directly from those institutions that are regulated by the SEC will also be cut. And that just ends up shrinking the SEC's budget. It's not saving the taxpayers whatsoever.
Well, this was, Jennifer Tabb, this is, I think, I'm very grateful for the work that James Stewart's done, but I wish this became a political issue because it really gives a lie to so much of the rhetoric on the right, particularly the Tea Party people, who were galvanized by their revulsion to what happened on Wall Street in the fall of 2008, and they ran with it as a sort of anti-government, citizens grassroots movement. Frankly, I don't understand why the White House didn't run with it, but that's another issue. The long and the short of it is, I just did an interview the other day with the nonpartisan group in Washington, the Center for Public Integrity. They've done a report called "Hired from Hired Hands to Hired Guns," now from Hired Guns to Hired Hands, about how this revolving door of lobbyists who become senior congressional staffers, and the huge uptick in lobbyists who are now on the senior staff in the United States House of Representatives. Almost all of them are with these new Tea Party freshmen, and here you have this evidence that they're cutting the ability of the Securities Exchange Commission to look into future fraud on Wall Street, if you put all those dots together, which is not exactly you don't have to be Einstein to follow follow the ball here, don't you think somebody ought to be able to make a case out of this?
I do, but I think that perhaps it's partially the press and partially people's facilities for logic. What happens is a story will come out, big story, you know, that the Madoff fraud was not investigated, and that's clear, and other examples. And so instead of saying, gee, we need the SEC, which had had a long history of being one of the tough, most intelligent regulatory agencies in Washington, instead of saying, okay, we need to have them improve, we need to increase their budget so that things like technology errors don't happen again, and also so that there are enough people that cases that have merit can actually be pursued. Instead of saying that, they're looking at some serious flaws and saying, well, then let's not have any cop on the beat. Let's just take even more of the authority away. And that's like, you know, the equivalent of having a small police force in a major city not being able to pursue the crime that's occurring. And instead of saying we need more cops on the corners and we need more investigators, saying let's cut the budget and have fewer since they're not doing their job. It's completely illogical. And I am really confused why that case has not been made.
So, Jennifer Taub, I suppose the other political puzzlement one has is what do you think is going to happen here vis-a-vis the fact that Elizabeth Warren, who was championed by lots of progressives, and almost in a way is a kind of lightning rod for progressives' hopes and values, if you will, since one of the few redeeming things to come out of the Wall Street meltdown, which, as the title of your book suggests, how Washington bailed out Wall Street and left Main Street underwater. The injustice is so manifest and so deep and so lasting. And here we have a recovery that's sputtering now. So the damage that was done back in 2008 may well continue, and it may be permanent. I don't know. I mean, what's your feeling about that? Let's answer that, if
sure.
you will.
Well, you know, you mentioned how will individual progressives feel, and how will progressives, I guess, as a group, if they're certain leadership organizations, react to this. And already we've heard some thoughts on this. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee, the PCC, has issued a statement saying that that clearly Elizabeth Warren was their first choice, but they've also endorsed Rich Cordray, who was the former Ohio Attorney General, who's had quite a successful track record in his, I think, short year in office, as I recall. I think it was a special election that brought him to that post. And he was part of the robo-signing scandals with the foreclosures. I think he was one of the key leaders among the state AGs in those cases back last fall. So I understand that they have supported him, but obviously, I think folks are disappointed at best. I think what I would say about that is, of course, people would feel disappointed. She is an incredible spokesperson for average consumers. She's clear. She had a vision. She's an able leader. But I would also say that as an underdog, someone like Cordray, and I mean underdog in terms of, you know, people are rightfully suspicious about Warren not being selected. As an underdog, I think he perhaps will have something to prove and may live up to the challenge. I'm reminded of someone from the 1930s who was an underdog, Ferdinand Pecora. And Pecora, as you may recall, became the head lawyer for a big Senate investigation of Wall Street. And when he stepped into the job, it was late January of 1933. And at that moment, that was the interregnum, because FDR wouldn't come into office until March 4th. And he stepped in and only had 6 weeks to prove himself. And he more than proved himself. He transformed the discussion, and through his incredible work cross-examining witnesses, he was able to change the discussion and really change the direction of banking and securities legislation. And the laws that his work helped push through. This is legislation that was, some of it was already in progress and some of it was drafted in the early, 100 days of Roosevelt's first term. But that legislation was definitely enabled by his ability to get the public's attention through his work. And the pieces of law I'm thinking of in particular are the Glass-Steagall Act and the Securities Act of 33. So I wouldn't write this guy off yet. I think there's something.
Well, but Jennifer, though, what you brought up something that's, I think, really, we'll close on this note here, because we haven't had a PCORA investigation. This hasn't happened after this 2008 meltdown. And as you know, nobody's gone to jail. And that wonderful filmmaker of that really important film, Inside Job, made that statement at the Academy Awards. And it's still hanging out there, isn't it? It's
Right. So that's some low-hanging fruit. Maybe Richard Cordray can pick it.
Yeah, but on the other hand, he may not get confirmed. He may not. He may go up against the same buzzsaw that Elizabeth Warren's been dealing with.
I think that the president may have to resort to a recess appointment at this moment.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Vermont Law School professor Jennifer Taub, who's an expert on business law. She coordinated the business law program at the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, was also associate general counsel for Fidelity Investments and assistant vice president for Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. Her forthcoming book is called The Great Betrayal, How Washington Bailed Out Wall Street but Left Main Street Underwater. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about what happened to the Egyptian Revolution.
High's the water, mama, 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, papa? She said it's 3 feet high and rising. Well, the hives are gone, I lost my bees. Chickens are sleeping in the willow trees. Cows in water up past her knees. 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, mama? 4 feet high and rising.
شهداء علشان يعلوا في مصر وقفوا يهتفوا شهداء وما همهمش يموتوا فيها وينزفوا شهداء
خمسة. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Her essay, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, is in the July 14th issue of the New York Review of Books, and she lives in Cairo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian.
And it seems to me that, well, let me ask you, do you think these changes announced today are a positive step forward? Not just the idea that they're going to sack over 700 police officers, including 505 major generals, 82 colonels, 82 brigadiers, and arresting 13 of these officers on charges of killing the protesters. But the military have said that they would draft guidelines for selecting the 100-member assembly that will write a new Egyptian constitution. And some analysts say that this could make it more difficult for any Islamist-led legislature to choose the body and therefore give the charter an Islamist slant. What's your reading on that?
Well, I think that, take the first part of your question, that the changes announced, I think that they're a step forward, but I don't think they're going to appease the protesters who are still in Tahrir Square. I was speaking to people today, and they're still not happy. They want the prime minister himself to go. They want the cabinet to change. So I think that even though it's a step in the right direction, I think that it's still considered somewhat cosmetic. About the Islamists, I mean, if we look back to the first a yes-no referendum vote we had after Mubarak stepped down, the group that was chosen to draft the proposed constitutional amendments, they included Muslim Brotherhood members. They included Islamists. And I think that in any sort of body that is chosen to draft something, there will be most definitely, both Islamist representation and representation of conservatives, because they do make up a significant portion right now of the political voice and discourse that we're seeing. I also think that, on the one hand, anything could happen between now and the elections, you know, slow down the process of sort of Islamists coming into a more powerful position within the government. However, I feel that they do represent a significant portion of the population. Egyptians are conservative. Islam is a core part of their daily lives, and, you know, we can't overlook that.
Well, it seems that what's happened so far is that the people who actually initiated the revolution and made most of the sacrifices are the ones that are getting shafted, to use a rather crude word, as opposed to the Muslim Brotherhoods, who in many ways sat on the sidelines. The ruling military council appears to be biased towards them. And in your article, Yasmin El-Rashidi, in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, you point out in a conversation with an Egyptian general that he says, with the Brotherhood, the military know what they're getting. With the revolutionaries and liberals, they don't.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this force that appeared out of nowhere, which was the momentum of the revolution, these people taking to the streets, I think that, you know, it surprised everyone. It surprised even the protesters themselves who went down on January 25th and 26th and 27th. Nobody expected it would be so large. And I think the military council is extremely weary. They're anxious about this force. When might it erupt again? You know, when might it rise again and threaten them next? I mean, about the Muslim Brotherhood having been on the sidelines, I have to disagree there in that although on January 25th, when one looked at the people in the square, for the most part they were young. A large portion of them were sort of upper middle class activist students, artists, professionals who are active on Twitter and Facebook. On the 28th, which was, I think, the turning point for what became the revolution, the demographic had changed significantly, and there was a much larger portion of the middle class, and the Muslim Brotherhood members were beginning to come out. By the 29th, when a critical mass had been reached, I believe it was because the Muslim Brotherhood and their followers had come out.
Was that because politically they realized that they were missing the boat? I mean, what explains their earlier caution?
Their earlier caution, I think, is based on sort of they were really oppressed under the former regime. They were rounded up and thrown in jail by the hundreds. And there have been many calls for protest before. Usually a few hundred people would show up. They would be cordoned off by police. After a few hours, some of them would be rounded up and thrown in jail. The others would eventually leave. And so no one really believed that the January 25th call would emerge as it did. Nobody really expected it to gather that many people or sustain itself in the way that it did. On the 28th, something changed. I mean, you could see that Egypt was on the brink of change. The riot police fled the streets, literally, because the youth protesters were so determined to move forward and take over the square. They battled through the tear gas, they battled through the rubber bullets, and the riot police were defeated. And that's when the army came down in the street. At that point, I think it was clear that the people's movement had a very different kind of momentum, a very different strength. And this was something that, yes, it was serious. I think they felt that the regime could not round them up and throw them in jail. It would be doing that to tens of thousands of Egyptians if it took that move.
Again, I'm speaking with Yasmin El-Rashidi, who's the author of the new book, The Battle for Egypt. Her article, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, is in the July 14th issue of the New York Review of Books. And I'm trying to get a sense of, obviously, history tells us in the case of the Russian Revolution and the more recent Iranian Revolution that there's an initial revolution that looks hopeful and then the hardliners emerge out of the woodwork and steal the revolution. So I think that's the subtext, is it not, of the fear about the Islamists?
It is. I mean, it is. And you know, if one asks, is Egypt moving in the right direction or the wrong direction? Most people, it's sort of become inherent to the wrong direction. is, you know, the question of the Islamists. Whereas I think that if one steps back and looks objectively, you know, the Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood, have worked very, very hard to reach out to the people of Egypt over the years, where the government has failed in offering subsidized goods and social services, the Muslim Brotherhood has stepped in. And that's how they gained their support. That's how they gained a lot of their followers. Not to, you know, not to mention, of course, their slogan, Islam is the answer. And, you know, as Muslims, they always say, leave it to Allah. You know, it's in God's hands. So they've won supporters by very strategically, you know, working at a grassroots level, offering what any government should. So could we call this stealing the revolution? You know, in a way, they've been working very hard too, but perhaps in a more, you know, proactive, organized manner. And I think that where the youth protesters have failed is that post Mubarak stepping down, they have not organized themselves and mobilized and come together to reach out to the people in the way that the Islamists are.
Well, I suppose this gets to the heart, and I take it that that's why the liberals or the revolutionaries or whatever the correct term for this inchoate group is, they wanted to postpone the elections, which is apparently happening, in order to get more organized. But I don't see necessarily a political platform there. But surely there is a broader issue here, isn't there, that Egypt is the heart of Arab culture, and it has largely developed along a secular and modern lines. And there is this notion, particularly when you have the Salafist elements, that there is a constituency, I'm not sure how big it is, in Egypt, fueled and by Saudi money, I believe, that wants to emulate the Saudi situation and create a kind of theocracy. So could you qualify that for us?
I think, you know, that there's a lot of talk now. I feel that the situation in Egypt has been painted in this portrait of black and white. You know, black being Egypt's about to become like Iran or Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think two things are important to keep in mind. Is one, that anyone who's been to Egypt understands Egyptians really like to have a good time. You know, they go out at night. There is alcohol, even though, you know, a lot of them don't drink. They enjoy music. Women like to dress up, but they put on makeup, even if they're veiled. And women work and drive. You know, life is not like it is in the West, but it is pretty open compared to other countries in the Arab world. I think Egyptians would be reluctant to let go of a lot of those freedoms. They are religious, but I don't think they would easily accept a state modeled on Saudi Arabia or Iran. And the Islamists, I think they understand that. And I don't think, you know, yes, I believe that we will move towards a more conservative state. We will move towards a state where Islamist thinkers have a much greater say in the political landscape of the country. However, I think that any changes they bring forward will be implemented very, very slowly, because they understand that to win the people over, they can't sort of suddenly overnight say, women have to cover up, they can't drive, they have to stay at home. They understand that they can't do that.
Well, I don't mean to sound like a stupid Westerner by beating a dead horse here, Yasmin El-Rashidi. I did speak fairly recently with the Egyptian novelist Al-Aswani, and it was he who brought up the Saudi specter, the Saudi money, the Salafists, and portrayed in terms of the counter-revolutions, if you will, to the Arab Spring as the Saudi regime. And he was quite outspoken about it. And indeed, it is true that during Tahrir Square, every day, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia would call up President Obama and scream at him and say, you've got to let Mubarak kill those kids in Tahrir Square.
Well, I mean, yes, one can't deny the Saudi. I'm so glad that Hosni Mubarak didn't listen to him, because I would not be speaking to you now. But, you know, yes, I'm not an expert on Salafism, but I have spoken to experts and I've spoken to Salafi, you know, leaders and sheikhs. There is Saudi financing of Salafi elements in Egypt. I don't believe it's state-funded, though. I believe it is single wealthy individuals who are channeling money to Egypt to support certain movements like that. And, you know, everyone knows, and there's evidence, documented evidence of it, that, you know, Saudi King offered billions of dollars to the military so that they do not move forward with the trial of Mubarak. So absolutely, Saudi Arabia has interests, and I think it's, you know, manipulating a situation in Egypt. But I don't think that alone is enough to sort of create the space for Egypt to overnight turn into an Iran or a Saudi Arabia. I have my concerns about the direction we're moving in, but I don't think it's going to happen in the short term. I don't even think it's going to happen in the medium term. And I think that when you look at, if you speak to the Muslim Brotherhood, the leading Muslim Brotherhood members and thinkers, when you look at their actions and their strategy, they're extremely savvy. They're savvier than sort of all of us liberals put together. And they will work very carefully both to make sure that the military remains, you know, complicit with them, and the military would not be in favor of, you know, an Egypt modeled on Saudi Arabia or Iran. And they will also work very hard to make sure that the liberals and the youth don't turn entirely against them, because they have sort of caused some, you know, waves of discontent since Mubarak stepped down, which is why they chose, after distancing themselves from the revolutionary movement, on July 8th, they chose to go back down in Tahrir Square in solidarity with the youth Muslim Brothers who, you know, had, who have had disagreements with them, and with the liberals.
So, Yasmin El-Rashidi, I recently hosted a forum at the UCLA Hammer Forum here in Los Angeles with Rabab El-Mahdi and Jawad Nabulsi, a young entrepreneur who was shot in the eye on the first night of the revolution, still has buckshot in his eye, as a matter of fact. And Rabab, you know, she was also a founding member, along with Ala Raswani, of Kafaya, the earlier movement. Both of these Egyptian activists made it very, very clear that they believe that the Arab Spring is inevitable, that all of these regimes, including the Saudi regimes, will eventually fall. Probably Syria soon, Yemen is teetering, et cetera, and even Saudi Arabia. So if they are right, much of what we're talking about would go away, because my understanding is if there is a youth revolution in Saudi Arabia, it would probably be rather anti-secular from the frustrated youth who can't stand the oppression of the Wahhabi theocracy.
I mean, absolutely. When you look at, you know, the Arab, the populations of the Arab world, 60% of the population of the Arab world are youth, I believe, under the age of 25. But I think, you know, I think what you know, the hinge of that is the hinge of which way things go, I think, boils down to economics. When you look at why, to take Egypt, why do people join the Muslim Brotherhood? You know, yes, I think that obviously, you know, we lean towards Islam in Egypt. It's the religion. People do have very strong faith. But what is the final thing that wins them over? It's sort of the economic promise. It's the subsidized goods. It's the social services. It's the support that these people are giving Egyptians in their day-to-day lives to enable them to put food on their tables. And I think Saudi Arabia, even though it's an extremely wealthy country, my father lived there for many years, and I've reported on it extensively, there is widespread poverty. And I think, again, there, you know, the youth are frustrated by the lack of freedom, but they are also frustrated by the lack of opportunity. And I think that ultimately it depends where the money is coming from.
I thank you so much for joining us here today. Yasmin El-Rashidi, and your article in the current issue of the New York Review of Book, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists. It seems in many ways that you're not talking about a monolithic movement. You're talking about and I understand that the Brotherhood is split into various factions, some conservative and some more modernist. So just in closing, qualify the Victorious Islamists, because you have not painted a picture of an inevitable Islamic victory in terms of who's going to be running Egypt.
You know, I think the victory comes in terms of actually where are we now, who has the influence, who has the organizational structure, who has the resources. And I think that ultimately is what will, you know, color or dictate who has the greatest influence in the country, even if they're not in the position of the president or the prime minister or the ministers. I think that if both on a grassroots level and on a level, managerial level, in terms of the government, there is a significant presence of Islamist or conservative thought, I would say that they are victorious. And from what we know, they are already, you know, in that position. If not, you know, in some cases, I think they're on their way to taking higher positions of office within the government. But they definitely have greater influence, a much more organized structure, a greater just movement of support than I think anyone else, any individual group right now in the country. So I think in many people's minds, they are already victorious.
Well, I thank you for joining us again, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the new book, The Battle for Egypt. Her article, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, is in the July 14th issue of the New York Review of Books.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Quiet voice, singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and this land here of the free. One time, one night in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.